Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and there's a film festival in town, you know. No, not the one with Nicole Kidman and Robert De Niro, but the one across the bridge in Brooklyn. It's the third annual Brooklyn Underground Film Festival, and while movie stars might be in short supply, it does have that swashbuckling action-adventure hero, Indiana Jones, except this indie movie was made by teenagers in Mississippi, a shot-for-shot tribute to the Spielberg original, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm joined by the movie's now-grown-up producer and star, Chris Strompolis, and by the director of Home, another film featured in the festival, Matt Zoller-Seitz, who, when he's not making movies, is often reviewing them for the New York Press. Welcome, Chris and Matt.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
First, this word, underground. What's underground about the films in the festival, and how is that different from independent?
Less money.
Less money, and probably, you know, content and the way that, you know, the way the films are, or what they choose to talk about and the platforms that they choose to take are probably a little edgier than you know, your common film festivals.
And they tend to be difficult. I think what maybe all the movies in Brooklyn's schedule have in common is that they're difficult to summarize in a sentence.
And your movie, Indiana Jones, the adaptation, wasn't even intended for distribution, I understand. Is that right?
Not at all. Actually, in fact, this was all, you know, the director of the film, Eric Zala, said, you know, some said, he says, like, none of this was ever supposed to happen, you know. And, you know, basically we shot it from 82 to 89. It sat on our shelf for about 15 years. And then it was discovered, you know, just about a year and a half ago by Eli Roth, who did Cabin Fever. And
82 to 89.
It sat on our shelf and collected dust for about 15 years. And none of this was ever supposed to happen.
It's taken, have you re-edited, electronically enhanced
haven't,
it?
Haven't anything? Touched it. Haven't touched a single frame. And you know, as Matt can attest, you know, it's degraded 80s video and audio, and so it's not being distributed. We're just choosing our festival selectively, and we channel a lot of its attention and energy towards educational and charity things that have to do with film.
So Chris, that's a level beyond underground.
Chris was nice enough to show me the movie a couple of nights ago, and I told him afterwards that it was one of the single greatest experiences of my life as a moviegoer, seeing this, because as a kid, like a lot of people, I dreamed of doing exactly what he did, and the fact that he got it done is amazing. And I told him, if it ever comes out on DVD, I'm going to buy 100 copies, carry them around in my shoulder bag, and if I ever hear anybody complaining that a particular task is too hard, I'm going to hand them a copy.
And talk about a role reversal. Usually they're trying to figure out how many people they can get to see a movie. You're kind of withholding it only for selected audiences.
That's correct. It's got a certain energy to it, and it's certainly not for every single moviegoer and an audience member. And because of, you know, obvious intellectual property and copyright law, you know, we can't get it into a situation where it actually generates a large amount of revenue. So that's the reason we place it correctly and navigate it in a non-exploitive way with film festivals that have, you know, excellent intentions and are affiliated with you know, nonprofit, you know, either charities or educational
organizations. Right, although in recent years, long since you finished it in 1989, it's become such a common thing for people to take either, you know, well-known music tracks and remix them, or, you know, mix them with other music tracks to create what they call original art.
Yeah, sure.
Or to do similar things with video. How many endings to The Matrix are there now out there on the
right.
web? It's the rights question is being asked anew.
Yeah, absolutely, and we've been very careful with that. You know, we've had the excellent luck and good fortune of having the sort of silent endorsement of the three entities that would be able to do anything about it anyway: Spielberg and Lucas and Paramount. You know, they've been very kind in sort of letting us, you know, quote unquote, letting us do what we, you know, just show it to people and share it with people selectively, just as long as we, you know, behave ourselves.
Well, I'm not in that select group. So would you tell me what, and tell our listeners, of course,
sure,
what exactly you adapted in Indiana Jones, the adaptation?
Well, basically, in 1981, when the film came out, I was so taken by the character of Indiana Jones, you know, sort of every 11-year-old boy was, you know, that I wanted to make that character my own, and I wanted to inhabit that world and inhabit the skin of Indiana to see if I could do it myself. And by by gosh, I was set out to do it. So got together with my buddies Eric Zala and Jason Lamb, and we set out to do as close a shot-for-shot remake and recreation of the original as we could, you know, given our resources. And little did we know it would take us 7 to 8 years to do it.
All right. Matt, do you think an adult filmmaker can match the passion and dedication of adolescent boys in a small town?
Well, we, unlike Chris, we don't have 14-year-olds setting themselves on fire and punching each other in a rec room, so the action quotient is a little lower. But it's, yeah, to answer your question, yes. And every I think everybody who makes a movie at this level, which is to say, you know, practically for nothing, has to run into that equation where, well, as a producer friend of mine says, fast, cheap, good, pick two. And that's right. Why it took me a year and a half to shoot this movie Home, which is a romantic comedy. It's an ensemble comedy with 24 characters, and it takes place entirely in a two-floor apartment.
In your apartment in Brooklyn,
my apartment,
right?
Yeah. And we shot it there. We stored the equipment there. Cast
Wait,
and crew
you can
members
fit
crashed
24
there.
People in your apartment in Brooklyn?
Well, did you see Night at the Opera?
Yeah, I remember guess you could fit 24 people.
The stateroom scene,
anything.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's like clowns in a Volkswagen.
Okay, and I've read it's very Brooklyn-centric, and I also haven't seen this film.
It is, and to the point where we debated among cast and crew whether we were getting a little too Brooklyn-specific, and there's references to Pip's Comedy Club and the G-Train and the Promenade, and they're not explained in the way that they would be in most movies. They're pretty much there for people who are from Brooklyn, and for everyone else, it may just be an exotic reference that passes over their head.
In fact, we have a little clip here from the movie Home.
Seriously, I like this guy. He's a very sharp, funny guy.
I know this
hey,
spot
man, I'm right here. I'm right here. You can talk
no,
to me.
No, I am. I'm talking to you. But I'm saying this is a spot in Sheepshead Bay.
It's Pips. Every Tuesday night, they have an open mic comedy thing. You should think about it, because you're pretty funny.
Pips?
Pips.
Pips?
Sheepshead Bay. Is that where you're from?
There. No.
Is that the accent I hear? Is that, Bay Ridge?
What are you, a linguist?
Wait, do you smell it? Testosterone everywhere.
That's fun. Good dialogue.
Thank you.
Let's see. I think you might have gotten all three in there.
Yeah, maybe so.
Good. What was it? Good, cheap.
Fast, cheap, good,
fast,
pick
fast.
Two.
Yes,
but
yes.
We the fast part was lacking. It took from the time we started shooting until when we locked picture, it was 2.5 years. Three if you count applying to festivals and trying to finish an output so you can show it theatrically and all those other things.
Do you feel a part of a kind of Brooklyn filmmaking tradition? Is there such a thing?
There's actually a Brooklyn filmmaking movement right now, which has gone largely unnoticed in the media, and I am one very small part of that, and there are other people working in Brooklyn who are just doing tremendous work, which for the most part is unseen at the moment, but I think that's going to change. There's a guy named Eric Werthman, who is a therapist in Brooklyn, who did a terrific movie with Roger Rees called Going Under. And there's and that's about a relationship between a therapist and an S&M expert, and he wants to actually have a meaningful relationship with her. That was at Cinequest, which is where we debuted. And mm-hmm. there's a guy named Brian Wiseman who did an existential drama called Losing Ground, which is like The Iceman Cometh, except it's set in a video poker bar. And one of the leading actors in my movie, Stephen Neve, whose voice you heard. He was a guy mm-hmm. advocating Pips. He's a writer, director, producer, and he directed a terrific movie called Good Humor, which is about a guy who buys an ice cream truck, and it's about the education of a small businessman. It's pretty bleak.
And how much of the current Brooklyn filmmaking tradition traces to Spike Lee or John Jarmusch?
Oh, well, a lot. And even back further to people like Alfred Leslie, who did Pull My Daisy, one of the early Beat films, and John Cassavetes, of course, Shadows. But this has been a recurring tradition in independent cinema of people with no means trying to substitute with style and hopefully some kind of originality.
Pull My Daisy with music by David Amram. Bet you didn't think I knew that.
Oh, no, I didn't. But the opening piece of music in our movie was selected because it sounded a little bit like that.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. We can take phone calls if anybody wants to chime in, and maybe any other filmmakers, call yourselves underground or independent or whatever, as we talk about this Brooklyn, third annual Brooklyn Underground Film Festival with two of the contributors, Chris Stompolis. Did you say Stompolis or Stompolis?
Strompolis.
Strompolis, who made Indiana Jones the adaptation, and Matt Zoller Seitz, S-E-I-T-Z, who, when he's not making movies like Home that's showing at the festival, is reviewing them for the New York Press. 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692. And Dave in Manhattan, you're going to let him talk to you even though he's from Manhattan? You're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hey, how's it going? I think it's great. You know, I just want to let you guys know that that's a great festival you're in. And there's another festival, talk about edgy, the Arlene's Grocery Picture Show. Let every film in. They show every movie.
I've actually written about them in the past. Those guys are pitching themselves off a cliff every year, and I think it's tremendous.
Yeah, they're showing over 500 films this year, and you talk about Cassavetes. They're honoring Ben Gazzara. He's their like award winner this year.
Cool.
Thank you very much, Dave. Chris, does digital video change the availability for independents and, for that matter, teenagers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think just the task of making a movie. I mean, I think, you know, digital cinema and digital camcorders and the digital world has completely changed the way that you make a movie. And I bet that it wouldn't have taken us so long, you know, if we had shot digitally, or maybe it would have. I don't know.
I think the key difference, the thing that makes it a little bit more feasible is the way that you edit. And it's not just the shooting, because that part is, I don't really see a whole lot of time saved, because you still have to light it and block it and figure out where to put the camera and where the actors are going to move. But the editing part of it, where it used to be that you needed an army of editors or one very, very anal retentive person who knew where all the various trims were hanging up on the wall, now you can store it all digitally. You can, if you're organized, you can arrange it in a way that's easy to access, and it's really not terribly different from editing a novel. You can just cut and paste things, delete things, change things.
I wonder if there are any other current or former teenage filmmakers out there who are aware of Indiana Jones, the adaptation, as kind of a cult classic in your world, or have some stories of doing similar things yourselves. Any other movie classics that you've chosen to manipulate or adapt? 212. We promise not to tell the copyright-holding producers. 212-267-9692. Doris in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Wasn't there a movie called, I think it may have been called, The Little Fugitive, about a kid who runs off to Coney Island?
Yeah, that's a fantastic one. That's from about 1954, as I recall.
That's the first Brooklyn film I remember seeing.
Yeah, and actually, Francois Truffaut, I believe, identified that as the beginning of what would become the new wave.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Thank you, and that's another thread of calls we could take. Your favorite Brooklyn movies, 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692. And Joey in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you, gentlemen?
Okay, Joey.
Great, good morning.
I'm the owner of Pips Comedy Club. We were thrilled to hear you mention that. I'd like to let everybody know that Otto and George will be appearing at 9:00 Friday and Saturday night.
Do you still have the open mic night every Tuesday?
No, sir. It's on Wednesday night.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we shot this movie in 2002 and 2003, so we probably should have called to check with your schedule before we released it.
Not at all. We're thrilled with the participation. Actually, I've also been working on a documentary film about Pips Comedy Club. It's got a very rich history. I'm working with a filmmaker named Damien San Marco. We've had some wild success. We interviewed Woody Allen, Robert Guillaume, Brett Butler, and you know, we're working on post-production right now.
This is another example of what I'm talking about. There's a lot of this happening in Brooklyn, and eventually people are going to figure it out.
And did you even know you were referenced in his film?
No, not at all. In fact, I was asleep 15 minutes ago. Damien Marco woke me up and told me.
Well, then, for your benefit, Joey, here's that clip again from the movie Home.
Seriously, I like this guy. He's a very sharp, funny guy.
I know this
hey,
spot
man, I'm right here.
Bay.
I'm right here. You can talk
no,
to me.
No, I am. I'm talking to you. But I'm saying this is a spot in Sheepshead Bay.
It's Pips. Every Tuesday night, they have an open mic comedy thing. You should think about it, because you're pretty funny.
Pips?
Pips.
Pips? Sheepshead Bay. Is that where you're from?
There. No.
Is that the accent I hear? Is that, Bay Ridge?
What are you, a linguist?
Wait, do you smell it? Testosterone everywhere.
You like that, Joey?
Love it. Absolutely love it. I think he summed up what I like to call the land of the mook.
Okay, Joey. Thanks a lot. Joey,
thank you very much.
The owner of Pip's Comedy Club in Sheepshead Bay.
That was Stephen Neve, the filmmaker I was talking about earlier. He's 6 foot five. He did everything himself on his own movie, and when we were shooting my movie, at one point a light over his head gave out, and rather than have a lighting technician come in and replace it, he grabbed a glove and did it himself just by reaching up, and our ceiling is, you know, about seven feet up. And when he was done, I said to the crew, pay attention to that. If you continue in this business, I promise you that it's the last time that you will see a leading actor change his own lighting in the middle of a shot.
All right. Betsy in Montclair, you're on WNYC.
Hey, my parents had a summer house in Bay St. Louis, and I just had to share that when I read the Vanity Fair article about you guys' movie, I felt like I had missed the opportunity to find my soulmate. I would have been in your movie. Like, I was running around Bay St. Louis the whole time you're making it. How did we not hook up?
Yeah, I don't know. Surprising, actually, that's Bay St. Louis. It's a beautiful, beautiful part of the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And in fact, we were at the other end in Ocean Springs. But in fact, Jason, myself, and Eric met in Bay St. Louis. That's where we all kind of went to school together. Is like, I had met Jason, long, long ago, like when we were like 8 and 9 years old. And there was an old school there. Obviously people from Brooklyn wouldn't know it, but it was called the Christ Episcopal Day School. Do you remember that
right,
school?
Yeah.
They've since shut it down. We had to wear those, horrible little red ties and the jackets and all that kind of stuff. But
all right. Sorry. Too bad you guys didn't meet as kids.
Yeah. Sorry.
She could have been one of your Marians.
Yeah. You could have been one of our Marians. Well,
we're going to sneak in Natasha here because we're almost out of time, but it sounds like she was living your life in France. Natasha.
Hi.
Hi. What'd you do?
We copied Star Wars.
Yay!
Great. Yeah.
Yay.
How can you resist? I was 12. My brother was 18. He had a video camera. Yeah. We kept the French soundtrack of Luke and Leia talking, and we just reenacted all the action.
How did you do the special effects?
Well, we had a beautiful orange blowing up for the Death Star, and it didn't really look that great, but,
Well, the intention was there. I mean, I think we've seen, Indiana Jones and Star Wars have been, that seems to make up the good base of fan films out there. There's that fan energy is good.
All right, Natasha, thanks a lot. And you guys have not only been great guests, you've inspired by far the best calls of the week. So, Chris Trompolis, who as a teenager made Indiana Jones the adaptation, Matt Zoller-Seitz, who made Home, both showing at the 3rd Annual Brooklyn Underground Film Festival. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.